In Crisis. From The Desert Storm. By Blue Sunshine. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of George Lucas. Chapter 6. We're losing the continent, a surveyor whispers hopelessly. Everyone in the Crisis Command Center watches the predictive program extrapolate the wave that is going to swallow the ground under their feet. Already the shaking is a non-stop presence which rolls in waves. Plo Koon gathers himself, feeling fear ripple out from the population as the world itself sighs in relief, even as it's ripped apart. Natural disasters are not evil, they simply are.
Order all transports to prepare for final evacuation,
Plo orders. Letting nothing of his own painful sense of how much they could still do waver in his voice. They did not have the time. They did not have the means.
We were not enough.
Sir, one knight hesitates. Sir, there's still 15,000 of the ground and more coming.
Then it is all or nothing,
Plo says firmly.
We do what we can.
His vocoder crackles and he steels himself, letting nothing but certainty and serenity out into the force.
Prepare for final evacuation.
Yes, Master Koon. The knight nods, struggling to quell their own distress.
We do what we can, he thinks wearily.
Koon leaves the temporary shelter they've set up, reaching out with his senses and trying to parse the energy crackling through the ground.
Master T,
he calls out. More in the force than anything else, as she stumbles out of her own transport, packed with survivors and being swarmed by medics. She hesitates, her first instinct to guide those she has saved, but she challenges herself to trust the medics and the rest of her team and moves toward him.
Master Koon,
she inquires, every inch of her the same shade of ashen brown, her teeth and eyes gleaming. He'd caught a glimpse of her this morning in her full huntress regalia, and had admired her courage and defiance in the face of an appalling judgment by his fellow counselors. But then he had never been a strict traditionalist himself.
Gather any other master you can find,
he says quietly, just for the two of them. Her eyes narrow and she tips her head thoughtfully, asking without asking.
We're going to form a perimeter, as wide as we can,
he says.
And we are going to hold this ground for as long as is possible.
The final evacuation, she asks,
gaze deeply troubled. She could feel the force crying out, telling her there were more they could save, just as he could.
We are losing the continent,
Koon admits gravely.
We are out of time.
Then we will hold, she vows, as long as we can.
Force be with you.
He bows his head. To his surprise, she reaches up and lays a hand on his cheek, and he can feel her sorrow and understanding through that comforting touch.
Force be with us all, she murmurs.
And then she is off at a force-enhanced run, seeking out the other masters through the haze and confusion of the thousands crowding the landing pads. Koon sighs deeply, and himself turns to the task.
You saved our lives there, ma'am.
The pilot wipes sweat off his brow as Shmi emerges from the maintenance hatch. She crawls out, fluid staining her hands and several bruises on her side and on her head, and glowers at him.
Get a different pilot, she orders. You've overheated the power regulators twice. If you do it a third time, they will blow, and all of us will die. You should not have claimed to know how to handle a craft you are not trained to fly.
Man, now hold on,
he protests, and Shmi crosses her arms. You don't understand.
Understand this,
she cuts him off.
This vessel is capable of carrying 2,000 souls, and is expected to be on the planet below immediately, and if we fail, they die. If you overheat the power regulators, they die. If you blow the thruster relay again, we'll fail to break atmosphere and they'll die. You are unfit.
He swallows. He's not a young pilot, cocksure of himself, but he's clearly out of his league.
I'm all we've got, he says helplessly. I had training on the old Besh Nines, and this seemed close enough. There just weren't enough pilots.
Shmi sighs deeply and wipes sweat off her neck, smearing more grease. She'd been sent on one of the last transports from the temple to ensure that those space birds they scraped into flying stayed in the air long enough to be of use,
and had ended up jumping from ship to ship as failures were suffered and repaired, and somehow ended up in charge when the chief mechanic for this convoy failed to join the rendezvous, his craft having dropped out of hyperspace well before the Rylor system. Mechanics on other vessels started reporting to her when she answered a question no one else could, and now... her two junior mechanics were currently on the ground, checking over those transports before they lifted after one of the first runs had gone catastrophically wrong, blowing a propulsion engine on liftoff. One astromech had been left on the last frigate, supplanting the faulty navigation system, and the other was now monitoring the power flow of this vessel with excruciating care.
"We do what we can," Shmi sighs.
"I will pilot. You will co-pilot."
"Are you sure?" he asks, nervous and ashamed. "I mean, you clearly have the mechanical knowledge, but no disrespect, Jedi ma'am."
"I am sure," Shmi told him with a confidence she didn't entirely feel. She had taken advantage of the simulators in the temple, partly to learn and partly... she loved flying, loved the feeling of taking off, even in simulation, and leaving worlds behind her, as easily as she wishes she could have left behind Tatooine and her past, and all the horrors there. But a simulator was not a ship, and no lives were in danger there.
"I am sure," she repeats, praying to Aramu for all of their sakes. "Mother, bless me and let me lift them from despair, as I have been lifted."
She blinks back sudden tears and bites her tongue at the overwhelming swell of emotion. That is the knowledge that she did not say goodbye to Anakin before she was swept up in the mission.
"No despair, no fear, no doubt," she scolds herself. "I'm not leaving him today. I'm not leaving anyone."
"Master Nasade!"
Adigalia calls out, halting them from across the corridor and turning a dozen or so curious heads. The Jedi all move towards each other, and the milling individuals in between slightly part to make way for them, though a few offer them only disdainful looks as they go around.
"You could have calmed," Ben remarks once they are at a polite distance.
"I wasn't looking for you," she says dismissively.
"I'm looking for the Corellian ambassador."
"He's with the Kalish representatives, or he was this morning," Ben replies. "They've agreed to take in as many as 20,000 refugees."
Addy's brow shoots up, impressed and assessing.
Ben tips his head in acknowledgement of the accomplishment, but claims no credit.
"The final evacuation order has been given on Rylor 4, Addy informs them.
"How many did we?" Qui-Gon asks, looming over his shorter counterparts.
Addy swallows tightly, blue eyes shadowed.
"From last report, 74,000, give or take, if we manage to get all of them off the landing platform that are already there."
The three Jedi share a moment of quiet, and Ben closes his eyes briefly, shuddering for the memory of planets he'd seen decimated during the Clone Wars echoed here and now. When he opens them, both of the other two Jedi are frowning pensively at his reaction, but he offers them no answers.
"We found placement for as many as 62,000, Qui-Gon says stiffly.
Addy looks between them again, doubly impressed.
"How did you get through to the committees that quickly?" she asks grudgingly.
"We didn't," Qui-Gon replies, drawling. "We bypassed them entirely."
He tilts his head towards Ben so she knows who to blame. She narrows her eyes at him and Ben shoots Qui-Gon a dirty look. Apparently, the reservations Jin held after their conversation yesterday were wearing off.
"Or I was entirely dismissed," Ben thinks sourly.
Well aware of the stubbornness of Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn.
"We do what we can,"
he sighs internally.
"Really,"
she says flatly.
"I made no promises of recompense. These worlds have offered their aid to the refugees of Rylor IV freely and in complete generosity. They're aware that they received nothing for this, and they have given their pledge regardless,"
Ben explains himself, feeling rather put upon to do so.
"The committees can be addressed in time, but our need was immediate.
It seems some good can come of politicians after all," Qui-Gon mutters ruefully.
Knight Gallia glares at him, and he colors, shifting apologetically. Ben lifts a brow. Having been entirely unaware that Adigalia could cow the great Qui-Gon Jinn.
"Interesting."
"By all the gods," someone breathed out as the transport lifted, not waiting for the doors to close. As the vessel rose above its own dust, full to the brim with shaken survivors and ragged-nerved rescuers, they could see an eye to the storm. 100 small transports or more pulling up into clear air. And around the landing platforms, dotted like monoliths, dozens of Jedi Masters proud and immovable. Hands held open-palmed at their sides, facing the ground. You could almost see a glow around them. Threaded between the Masters, a hue of blue or gold or green, and beyond them, beyond that, destruction. The world was writhing and roaring, massive hills rolling like waves on water, great chunks of stone and earth lifting and collapsing. The main settlement swallowed in the turbulence, and a great black cloud in the distance coming for all of them. "I didn't know Jedi could do that," someone whispered in awe. "Just stop the world." "Not the whole world," someone else replied, watching ash and fire rise in the horizon. The doors closed, catching the dust from the dozen other ships rising in their wake. Obi-Wan, Sweet Joy, and Cien Jaezel stand out of the way, backs pressed to the pallets they've packed and brought up as transports start trickling back into the temple, spewing dust and ash-laden Jedi and mechanics and medics. It had been 4 whole days since the cry for help came from Rylor 4, and seemed at once both shorter and longer. The temple felt eerily devoid with so many absent, and it gave Obi-Wan the chills. He was not alone in that, and once the junior Padawans were essentially finished and the storeroom greatly reduced, they had taken to engaging the initiates to distract them from the bright absence of the temple population, for which the Creche Masters were exceedingly grateful. They all ate together, at scheduled times, and even then it was painfully obvious how bereft they were with just the initiates, junior Padawans, elders, and a few scattered masters in residence. So they were greatly relieved that the rescue teams were starting to trickle back in. The reports were underwhelming. 71,489 survivors. They saved as many as they could, it just didn't seem like enough. What made it worse, so much worse, however, was that Obi-Wan could see how upset the returning Jedi were or had been. Tear tracks were blatantly obvious on soot-stained faces. One Wookiee had shuffled off the transport and over to the edge of the platform, jerkily trying to brush the clumps of dirt and clay from their fur with very little success. "Come on," Obi-Wan says, nudging Cien Jaezel with an elbow and Sui Choi with a hand. "Get them some water. We'll take them to the dining hall to get something to eat or anything."
"We'll get in the way," Sweet Joy points out. "They look..."
He trails off glumly, the force feeling heavy and oppressive, like rain clouds on an already damp day.
"That's the point, I think," Cien says, nodding and pushing away from the pallets. "They've done what they can for Rylor 4, so we'll do what we can for them."
Sui blinks and nods, brightening.
"Okay, understand."
He pulls the purple and bronze contraption from his belt, where it's been tied for several days as they puzzled what function it possessed, and darted into the throng of weary knights and masters and temple employees, holding it up and smiling widely, eyes bright and soothing. He earned puzzled looks and awkward smiles, a few knights prodding the object curiously and shaking their heads in bafflement, the tension bleeding away from their bodies for the distraction. Jaezel herself skipped over to a trio of shell-shocked-looking knights and took the hands of 2 of them without warning, skipping them towards the lifts and herding the 3rd knight with them, and a few more along the way. Obi-Wan nods to himself and ducks around the milling personnel over to where the Wookiee was standing, hands covering their face, upset spilling off them, uneasily released.
"Here."
Obi-Wan pulls a comb from his boot, where Choi had stuck it as an extra and Obi-Wan had forgotten about it. He has a feeling that maybe there was the will of the Force in that.
"I think I can help you," he says, offering a smile.
"We do what we can," he thinks. "And this I can do."
For the text of this and other stories by the same author,
visit the AO3 page of Blue_Sunshine. Music is Lonely Desert by Emily of Roll for Fantasy. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find other ways to support me, as well as a link to my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.